Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast all things college golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's guest on Better Than I Found It is Cincinnati head coach Doug Martin. Now, Doug's journey to the coaching profession is a bit different than most coaches. He was at one point the number one ranked junior player in the country, and he won the 1984 U.S. Junior. His college career at the University of Oklahoma saw him earn All-American honors three times, and he was also the runner-up to Phil Mickelson in the 1989 NCAA Championship at Oak Tree in Edmond, Oklahoma. At one point, he was also the number one ranked amateur in the world. That week at Oak Tree, though, included another great accomplishment, as he and his Sooner teammates carried away the NCAA team title. Doug talks about the fond memories he has of that week. He eventually went on to a successful eight-year career on the PGA Tour before injury cut his playing days short. Now in his 15th year at Cincinnati, Doug describes the positive impact that moving to the Big 12 Conference has had on his program. I have a lot of respect for the way he runs his program, and I hope you enjoy the listening. Okay, it's time to say hello to a very good friend of mine and a terrific coach, University of Cincinnati head coach, Doug Martin. Doug, really awesome of you to join me today. I'm Better Than I Found It.
Oh, I'm certainly excited. The amount of respect that I have for you and what you've done in this profession, and, very fortunate to have learned a lot from you and most importantly, have a great friendship.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the underrated part. We all get so wrapped up in results and recruits and who we're getting, who we're not getting, raising money, that we forget we're building incredible relationships that really kind of last forever. And even when a guy gets out of coaching, you still keep in touch with him. So anyway, great to be your friend. And I'm going to talk about your move to the Big 12 Conference, which just means we're going to see each other more than we did in the past. But I want to start by asking, what were your impressions of Whispering Pines this past week in Trinity, Texas, for our Big 12 championship? I know I'm in love with the place. What were your impressions?
Well, it didn't take me long, when I kind of looked at the course every single day, just kind of looked at the surroundings. It didn't take me long to after the tournament to send a message to the Big 12 office about, what a facility this place is, how the golf tournament was run. Once you come in that gate to when you exit that gate, nothing but first class. As far as the golf course goes, it quickly made my top 10. I've been to a lot of great places in my career, not only coaching but also playing. And the thing that I liked about Whispering Pines was the shot values that you were forced to hit. You had opportunities where you could score, but you had opportunities where par was at a premium. I thought every shot was very important on that golf course, from driving the golf ball. You had to have great distance control. I thought the golf course was set up incredibly well. 16 would have been my only question, just playing that hole at the length that we played it. I thought that was a lot to ask on the 36 hole day to play it at 250 and 259. But as far as just a true championship venue, to where you're going to get the best team that plays the best that week is going to come out of there. And just the Big 12 being a 72 hole event, that's championship golf.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I have been saying for many, many years, we've got the best rotation of golf courses. We have a 72 hole championship, which is great. Whispering Pines doesn't have to apologize to anybody. Par was a good score in every hole all week long. It's fantastic.
Yep.
And you're going to get to see Southern Hills, which I'm sure you've played in a tournament before.
Yes.
You're going to see Prairie Dunes as well. So
yep,
you're going to love the rotation. But one of your players pretty much loved Whispering Pines as well. That's Ty Gingrich. He played beautifully this week and tied for first place. There was no playoff. Three champions, Preston Stout from OSU, Ty, and then Gustav from TCU.
Yep.
Thought it all very deserving champions. Tell me what you thought for him. And that was a fantastic way to enter the Big 12.
Well, Ty's been a very interesting story here in our program. He's been, a huge part of our continued growth. He, as most players do, really went through about an 8 to 10 month struggle here, to where his game was really not in the place that I would have expected it to be. And he just couldn't get out of the funk, no matter what we did, from, you know, working with some mechanics to working with mental stuff to focusing on short game to just everything we did. Nothing seemed to really give any return on results. And he really had, you know, I think at one point this last semester, I subbed him out at Big 12 match play. If you had ever told me after this kid's sophomore or junior that he ever wouldn't play for us, I would have, you know, probably been crazy. But he really was in a bad place with his game and really didn't have a good start to the spring semester, but started to show some progress and some good things when we were at Mossy Oak, which was our second to last event before our last event before the Big 12 championship, and really did some nice things there. I think he finished seventh at Mossy Oak. And then he just came to the Big 12. And one of Ty's strengths when he was playing great was his ability to drive the ball. Great iron player. And really those two things were key things at Whispering Pines. He had a great practice round. We talked about his mindset of, you know, being where your feet are, accepting the challenge of all the difficult shots that you're going to face this week, and then go let yourself be free and play. And that's really what he did. And I think he had a tough stretch kind of in the middle of that last round, but to birdie 5, 6, and 7, which were his, 14th, 15th, 16th holes. You know, I was with another player and I went out and I met him and I said, all right, you've played great this week. You've played well enough to win this golf tournament and let's go win it now. And, you know, that was really, you know, we capsized it into a really 5-hole event. And I said, let's go get this thing done. And he hit great shots in on 5, 6, and 7, 3 great birdies, hit a great putt on his last hole, number 9, to get to 10 under. And that was my goal for him at the start of the day, was get to 10 under par.
Well, he almost got there. He got to nine. Was good enough. So congratulations to him. What a conference, what a victory, by the way. And should you guys go to postseason, he's going to be on top of the world with confidence after that win. So, yeah, well done. So, you know, we talked about Whispering Pines. We both fell in love with it. I fell in love with it years ago, and I keep on telling coaches, you're going to love it when you get here. And I think that they all felt the same as you did, that like, okay, this is championship. Par means something. Here we go. That brings up the other question. What do you feel the impact is going to be for Cincinnati golf and Cincinnati athletics as a whole coming into the Big 12? I mean, initially, what's the impact going to be for your program? And long term, what do you think?
Yeah, first of all, this is basically where I grew up with college golf, playing at Oklahoma, seeing all of these schools, competing against these schools in most of the tournaments that we played when I was at Oklahoma. That's the first thing. The impact is, I have great respect for every program. I have great respect for every coach, and I have great respect for the vision of this conference and what they want to do with their championships. The proof is in the 3-course rotation that the Big 12 has. You're playing championship golf every year. There's no, you know, course where 40 under par is going to win. It's just, you've got to go out, and you said par is the value. So being in this conference with the coaches and the programs is very important to me. This is where I've wanted to take our program from when I started. And I wanted to grow this into a program that, number one, would be respected, and number two, would be competitive on the national level. And, you know, my biggest challenge here is we really don't have a history. We don't have a history from when I started. And everybody in the conference, they have stuff that they can put on their walls. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of things that I can put on my walls right now. So I have to continue to build. I have to continue to build that. So I anticipate our program to continue to grow. I will not be outworked as a coach. I want to recruit hard. I want to bring in the best players we possibly can to our program and then help them develop into good players and great men.
You know, I love that answer. It starts with recruiting the guys you get in here and then how you develop them once they get there. But now you're doing it in a more upscale, if you will, conference. It's been a great golf conference for many, many years. And so I'm glad you love the first taste of the, well, actually you had Big 12 match play last fall. So yeah. You've already had a taste of that, but it's great. You know, people who follow the college golf closely probably see you as your coaching career. They've seen you at tournaments. You've been recruiting. You do work hard at that, but they don't know much about your amazing junior career, amateur career, college career, and then professional career. You were a player way before when you were a coach. You were obviously a player. So give me your start in the game and who was the most influential person that had an impact on you as a young guy?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of us start and it's either an instructor, a father, someone. You know, my dad was basically the influence, and he tells the story frequently of he started playing in college when, you know, I was his first child, and as he started, he would carry his one bag on shoulder, me on the other, drop me off in a greenside bunker, and I'd play in the sand while he was finishing up the hole, and then he'd carry me on. And so, you know, from that standpoint, when he got me started in the game at like probably 4 or 5 years old, it was really, hey, I wanted someone to be able to play this game with as we continue to age together. And, you know, who would have ever thought that it turned into what it turned into? And, you know, I think the things that he taught me in golf really kind of came from a different source. And that would have been, my father was an athletic director and a basketball coach. And so I played basketball for my father in high school. And I think in the 3 years that I started for him, we lost 5 games. Mm-hmm. I was his point guard way back then. We went together and we scouted teams together. So I knew the team like he knew the team. So everything that I watched him do was, as a high school basketball coach, who gives the team a scouting report on every team? He watched video. So he really kind of taught me the infrastructure of how to be prepared to play and compete and how to be organized, which I think is one thing that a lot of young players today really lack, is their ability to organize a practice schedule, organize their time. He taught me that at a very, 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 very early age in high school when it was such an impactful time. You know, his motivation to me and how he challenged me and things that made me tougher as and more competitive. One of my favorite stories, when I played for him, we're the number one ranked team in the state of Ohio my senior year in basketball. I was a starting point guard, but I had to take visits to decide where I wanted to go to school when we started basketball practice after high school golf. So I missed like 3 or 4 scrimmages and 4 or 5 practices to go take all these visits. And he calls me in about 10 days before our first game and said, you know, son, I can't justifiably start you for the first 7 games because of all that you've missed. And man, that hurt. That hurt. But at that time, that was like, I can't believe this is occurring. But as I look back, there were other players that were at practice, that were at the scrimmages, that were working hard. We had a deep team, and that just really taught me a lot about, you know what, you missed, someone here is working hard, I've got to give them the opportunity. And so just, that was an unbelievable lesson that it took me probably 10 years later to figure it out. And the other thing that he did, which was, you know, probably the best thing a parent could do. I remember winning the U.S. Junior and he was like, good job. didn't really have much to say. But in 94, 95, I finished 3rd, 4th, 5th at Pebble at the AT&T, which is no longer, I don't think it's called that anymore. But he was out there for it. And we went to dinner after the last round. And it was like the first time he said, you know what, you're really damn good. And it's like that moment to where, because even in basketball, when I played good games, I was just another guy on the team. It wasn't like I'd come home and be like, man, you were great tonight. That just never happened. You know, that came from my mother. But, you know, he taught me so much about toughness and, you know, just was a tremendous coach to play for. And he just taught me unbelievable, valuable lessons in another sport away from golf.
Well, it sounds like to me he was not only a big influence on your playing career and how you managed that and how you prepared and all that, but some of these lessons have actually yielded fruit as a coach today. Sounds like it to me.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioned you won the U.S. Junior and you were the number one ranked junior player. You would go on to be the number one ranked amateur player. So you had a bunch of really good success. But I know you ended up from Ohio. You ended up at University of Oklahoma. How did you end up there? How did David Yates, the coach at that time before Greg Gross, how did he get you there? And tell me a story about the U.S. amateur at Oak Tree in 84. Yeah. I was there, but tell me that. Go ahead.
So starting off from a recruiting standpoint, you know, being from Ohio, I didn't feel the best golf in the country was being played in Ohio at that particular time. I felt the best golf in the country was being played in Texas, Oklahoma, Arizona. And I felt that if I could somehow navigate myself to the South, not necessarily Florida, but to the Midwest, Southern part, Texas, Oklahoma, somewhere there, I was going to have a chance to grow and to be the player I wanted to be. So I went on my visit to Oklahoma. Todd Hamilton was my host, who was British Open champ, unbelievable successful career in Japan, PGA Tour, was a tremendous host. I went to the basketball game, watched Wayman Tisdale score 63 points from, you know, the first row of the courtside seats. Just had an unbelievable experience. I'm a huge sports guy. And at that time, you had Barry Switzer coaching the football team. You had the basketball team that was great. Baseball was great. I felt golf was moving in a direction, very positive direction. Andrew McGee had just graduated. Things were trending. And probably the thing that, you know, I use some in my recruiting is I wanted to bring something to Oklahoma that they hadn't had. You go to Oklahoma State, you go to Texas and these places that I went to see. If I had a great career at one of those schools, I'm another guy on the wall.
Mm.
Those people weren't on the wall. You had Charlie Coe, you had Todd Hamilton, Grant Waite. You had some guys that had helped develop this program, but nobody really took this to the national level. And when David recruited me, I told David, I said, David, I want to win a national championship before I get out of here. It's really that simple. And I think we can do it here. I know there's no signs that could possibly occur, but this is what I want to do. And then David left after my freshman first semester to go to IMG, which I later signed with IMG when I turned professional. Basically all through David, but Greg came in, took over the job, you know, did a great job really continuing to build the program. And, you know, sure enough, my senior year, we win a national championship. But onto the recruiting process, which was, you know, I don't know all this until later. But with winning the U.S. Junior, I got an exemption into the U.S. Amateur that year, which was at Oak Tree. Mm-hmm. Where I think Sam Randolph and Scott Verplank went to the finals and Scott won the championship. But there was a fight between David and Coach Holder as to who was going to get me to stay with a Sooner or a Cowboy. I ended up staying with Fred Lutz at that time. He was a dentist in Oklahoma City.
I know, and Fred. He was a state amateur champion.
Yes, yes. And so that was – you know, a great experience. And I really didn't even know what was going on here. And I actually stayed Tim Straub, who is now the coach at Davidson. He had won the U.S. Junior the year before I did. And so Straub and I stayed with Fred And I had no idea what was going on until later after the time. And, you know, Coach Holder was always needling me during my time at Oklahoma about, you know, I couldn't even get housing for you at the U.S. Amateur.
Well, I was at that U.S. Amateur, and I remember watching Scott Verplank and Sam Randolph in the final, but I didn't know much about you at the time, but you were obviously a very good player. And that's going to take us to your college career, where something very impactful also happened at Oaktree. Not Oaktree National, but Oaktree Country Club on the other side of the road. But in college, you won five times at Oklahoma playing for Greg Grost. You were three-time All-American. You actually were runner-up in the NCAA Championship 1989 at Oaktree East, and to Phil Mickelson. That was his first of three NCAA titles. Only guy to ever do that. I was there at that event as well. But that week has to have special memories for you as a player. But you guys won the team title, and that's something you told David Yates you wanted to do when you went to Oklahoma. What are your most vivid memories of that week?
I think probably looking back, so this also was the first year where you had to qualify for the NCAA championship. And it was always when I went to school, freshman, sophomore, junior year, we knew what was going to happen in May or June. We were going to play in the NCAA championship. We were going to be one of the best three teams in our region. We knew that. So the whole year was prep for the national championship. Now we have, my senior year, we had this regional, all of a sudden this regional deal come around where you have to play. And I remember we had to play some golf in the last round. I think we were ranked number one or two going into regionals. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy for us. And we really had to come together, I believe, in that last round to get out. I think we ended up finishing second in the regional, but we were in a position to where we could have gone either direction. And I think as a group, we really came together in that regional, and we really became a team, and we really believed in one another. Then obviously having the NCAA championship in your backyard, and we spent, you know, probably my junior year, we spent a lot of time playing the East. We would typically, my first couple of years when we went to Oaktree, we played the men's club or Oaktree National, what it is now. And we really didn't venture over to the East or the West, that off to the family course, I think is what it was called at that time. And we just spent a lot of time out there working on understanding the golf course and how to play the golf course and where to leave the ball and all those things. And, you know, sure enough, it was a special week with four other guys and a coach that was like, it was magical. We were in a situation at the end to where the last nine holes, we basically couldn't mess it up. And I remember vividly, I think it's the 14th hole, the long par three over water on the back nine.
Yes, which, by the way, in those days with the wind in and off the left was a one iron. It was one ridiculous. Iron.
So the pin is in the back right corner there in that little neck. And we make three twos in the last round. Myself, no way. Ricky Bell, and Matthew Lane all make two. And so basically, all we had to do on 16 and 17 was keep the ball dry. Mm-hmm. We were going to win the national championship because I think we ended up winning by 15 or 17 shots. And so we'd put ourselves in a great position, but you know, just the memories with those guys winning a team championship, accomplishing something that you set out to when you first stepped foot on that campus was an awfully rewarding experience.
Yeah, I can certainly imagine that was great. But I remember that week very well. And I thought to myself, the team that's going to win this week is going to play 14, 15, 16, 17 yep. better than anybody
yep.
else.
Yep.
It played really, really hard. That was a Bellotta golf ball. You were hitting thin one iron.
Yes.
Different day and time. Yeah, absolutely. Well, so you win that national championship. I know you didn't mention Tripp Davis. Tripp just redid Ridgewood Country Club here in Waco and did a fantastic job on our home course. So I'm really thrilled by that. But anyway, You played the PGA Tour for 8 years. So I know there's a lot in there. You won on the tour. I think you lost a playoff to Vijay in a tournament on tour. Tell me just the kind of some of the things. I mean, we're going to get back to the coaching here in a minute, but portion of this, but you played with a lot of legends of the game. What are some of the memories you had of playing with legends?
Yeah, just, I encompassed an interesting with my career, the Nicklaus, the Palmer, the Bob Tways, the Davis Loves, Fred Couples, Ernie Els, and then all the way really to Tiger Woods. My last year was 99, the first part of 2000. I think the thing about these guys that I would say they all had in common was they were professionals. And one of my very good friends is in coaching right now. He coaches in the XFL. And when he went into coaching, I was like, he had been a collegiate coach. And I said, the one thing you're going to find real quick on your football team is who are the pros and who are the pretenders. And he really was like perplexed with what do you mean? I said, you're going to find out real quickly. Those guys are going to watch the extra film. They're going to do the extra things to be more prepared on game day. And just, watching the way Nicklaus went about things, the way Davis Love, the way all these guys prepared to get themselves ready to play. And then once they started to compete, how they're able to let go and be their best in competition. That's one of the things that, I always respected about guys like that is their games did not lessen or lower when they competed. They raised to a new level. And to me, that's what Nicklaus did. That's what Palmer did. That's what Davis Love did. Tiger had an uncanny way of doing that to where, even at times when he wasn't at his best, he still was able to elevate himself, whether it be making a great up and down, a great saving par, hit a shot. I mean, we all have watched this over the years, but just the experience, playing on the PGA Tour is every young man's dream. And going from spot to spot each week, playing that golf course in the best condition it will be for that week, the entire year, playing against the greatest players in the world, on an unbelievable stage. I'm not sure it could get any better, but just I learned a lot from these guys, and I really learned a lot too, just in the evenings when we went to dinner together, just talking about their families, how to be a better father, how to be a better person. I'm a guy who likes to continue to learn, and I feel like once you stop learning is when you die.
I agree with that. Some men are live to be 75. They're buried. What is Ben Franklin had a great quote on that. I remember that. But anyway, yes, you got to live and you got to learn and get better. So you had 8 years on the tour. I know injury took you off the tour, and a few years later you became a coach. I want to ask this question. What about your playing experience where you're able to win at every level? You won the biggest junior golf tournament in the world. You were the number one ranked amateur, number one ranked junior. You played the tour and won on tour. What about that playing experience has aided you in your coaching? Because I know your players must respect the fact you've done it at the highest level. How has it aided your coaching?
I think, hard work was my foundation as a young player. I just, I refused to be outworked. It's something my dad really was great with me. He didn't push me like, hey, you need to be at the go. But I remember him, if I would come in, they'd usually take me to the golf course at 8:30 in the morning and either pick me up or I would drive home sometime 7 o'clock. I was basically a golf course rat, 10 or 11 hours. But days when I came home early and I walked in the house, he would always go and just look at his watch. And he'd be like, just so you know, there's 3 or 4 more hours of daylight in California. Just dropping hints of like, hey, Don't be outworked. But, you know, as far as, you know, how it's helped me as a coach, you know, our program has grown so much from when I started from a national ranking standpoint to internal support from our athletic department. Just everything has continued to move forward in a positive direction. You know, I continue to see our program developing just because financially we're in a better situation being in the Big 12. More opportunities are going to come our way. But, you know, back to kind of the coaching part is I've been blessed to see other coaches that are highly respected in the profession of coaching coach their teams from way closer than most people ever get. Lou Holtz at Notre Dame, Skip Holtz through his tenure, Mick Cronin when he was here coaching at Cincinnati, who is now at UCLA, Wes Miller, who is our current basketball coach. So when we get into our off season, or when I was even in my off season, when I was playing on tour, I would go to Notre Dame games and Coach Holtz would have me as his guest and in the locker room at mass in team meetings, and to see how those guys orchestrate their team and the importance that they put on. If you love and care for your players, they will do whatever you ask them to do. When they know that you love them and you care for them, they'll do whatever you want them to do. And that's kind of what I've based our program on, is all of my guys know, first and foremost, I love you. Second of all, I care about what you do, not just your golf, but what you do on your daily, you know, your daily routine. So I've been very blessed to have a lot of people to learn from, ask questions, see how they deal with kids. I've been very fortunate to see things way closer than most people would ever see a program run from the infrastructure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's really neat to see the steady success. And there was no success at Cincinnati Golf before you got there. I think you were ranked in the 200s when you got there. Yep. What's the highest ranking you had in recent years?
25th last year.
Yeah, 25th last year. And you got your first regional bid in school history. Mm-hmm. And truly, your team is on the bubble right now. We're going to talk about that in a minute. So there's a good chance you'll get a bid this year. We're hoping for you, obviously. But it's neat to see that kind of steady progression. And you obviously are one of the hardest working guys. I've taken a little bit of pride in trying to have that moniker myself. I love to work hard, but I love it when I see another guy who's doing the same. It's really, really good.
Well, let me just talk about your hard work for a second. So I knew how hard of a worker you was when I had my son at the Junior World Golf Championship in Torrey Pines. And I remember you showing up on the 9th or 10th tee at 6:30 a.m. when he was playing. And at that time you were at Oklahoma State and you made a comparison of him to like Kevin Tway or what have you. But to see you there watching my son and how hard you worked was, again, it's just a testament to who you are. And, you know, it was really amazing to see you out there watching him play.
Well, thank you. I remember seeing that and wondering if you could get him to come to Cincinnati, but you couldn't quite get that done.
Yeah. Well, I just, you know what, his deal with coming to Cincinnati had everything to do with my father and I, when I was younger. You know, our relationship was challenged at times just because of the basketball deal. And I didn't want that for my son. I wanted my son to experience college away from me and try to grow and become a man on his own.
Well, he was a very talented young man. I remember thinking that at that time. So, and you know, not all sons of really good tour players become good players. And it's tough. I mean, and I looked at, you mentioned Bob Tway earlier, and I really think the reason Kevin is still playing professional golf today, he was a U.S. junior champion just like you. It was a four-time All-American for me at Oklahoma State, was because Bob never forced it. He never pushed it. Kevin came to the game on his own. In fact, every year at golf camp, Kevin would always tell me, I'm not even going to play golf. I'm going to be in the NBA. And I said, well, Kevin, you don't play defense, so that's not going to happen. So, but I think that's great when a tour player doesn't force his son to play and his son comes into the game on his own terms.
Yeah, right? Cody started playing when he was 13 or 14 years old.
Unbelievable. I mean, that's the way it ought to be. Come to the game on your own terms. Yep. So congratulations on your recent success. And I'm crossing my fingers right now, hoping you guys get that bid. I know you're right on the bubble, so hopefully that happens. So I asked this question to you beforehand so you could kind of think about it, but what's the most inspiring story? And I think you've come up with a story where you can't even mention the name because he's a future recruit. So go ahead and tell that story, even though you can't mention his name.
Yeah, so we have a young man that we've recruited, and this happened last fall. I think it was in the regional golf tournament, but the team's driving to the regional championship. The team van breaks down. He fixes the team van so they get to the regionals. They get their, you know, last minute type deal, makes a hole in one, shoots 65, wins the regional championship. And then that evening, he's a volunteer firefighter, 16-year-old kid, and goes and puts out a fire that evening around 6 o'clock, 6:30 at night. So, you know, that piece is just, you just don't think about young men under the age of 20, 21, probably being a volunteer firefighter.
No, but that kid sounds like a coach's dream. You need to get him on campus sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that's good. And, you know, you haven't been coaching quite as long as I have, but you're going to run into a story of a player that's just going to really inspire you. This may be the kid. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows?
So in the 15 years you've been a coach at Cincinnati, you've had thousands of interactions with other coaches. What's the best piece of advice another coach gave you, something that you value a great deal to this day?
I mean, there's been so much information, but I think when I go to tournaments and we're playing with other teams, especially teams that are coached by guys that I respect, I really watch how their players do things, how they handle adversity. Are they detailed with their shot preparation? Is, you know, we have so much information now in these yardage books that we never had in golf, and how we can use the Strack-A-Line books or whatever book you use to locate where you want to place the ball. I watch how the kids prepare. I watch how they handle themselves. I watch how they dress. But really the things that I look at is doing the simple things well is one of the things that I look at when I watch other teams that I want to model my team after. If you drive the ball on the fairway and you got 150 yards to the green, the simple thing is to hit the ball on the green, not chase a tuck pin over water, over a bunker, plug it in the bunker and make double. You know, those are what things do that teams that beat themselves. I don't ever want my team to beat themselves. But I think really, you know, I've taken practice ideas from different coaches. I'm huge on practice. I have a philosophy as a coach. I like to do all my work at home with my players. And when they go on the road, I want them to compete and play the game of golf. And I don't try to interact unless I feel interaction is necessary. I really want them to go and compete. I spend most of my time driving around the course, maybe looking at advance to see, okay, if I look on Golfstat and I see, wow, this hole, there's a lot of bogeys, doubles, triples, I'm going to go in advance and I'm going to observe, why is that happening? What's going on here? Can I then pass some information on to my players? You know, we talk, you know, I'm very detailed with my players on, you know, so many of today's kids zap that Bushnell, shoot the flag and be like, oh, this is my number. They don't realize, oh, it might be 152 hole, but 147 is my landing point. The ball's going to release. So we do all of that stuff at home. We try to put them in situations every day in practice that challenge them and put them in situations to where that they have to make the appropriate decision, and then I try to let them go play. But I learn every day from watching other coaches coach, watching other players play, other teams play, and just how they go about things.
So you think you pick up a lot of different things from a lot of different coaches through observation?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's important. That's the way kids used to learn the game of golf before swing instructors.
Yes.
Okay, so you had a college experience. I had one. I was at Central Oklahoma. And,
yep.
I have a lot of great memories of how college golf looked at the Division II level. You've had it at the highest level. But what are the best changes you've seen for college players today compared to what you had? Because all of us always think, well, our day was the best, but it really wasn't, because there's been some improvements. Best changes you've seen from your days as a player?
The biggest change that I really, really like is the second coach. I think the second coach is one of the best changes. You know, we are the only sport that we don't get to see all five of our players playing at one time. We can't call timeouts. We have to really try to evaluate a kid after a tournament. And we may have watched him play five holes in this 54-hole or 72-hole event. It's not a fair evaluation. You know, so the second coach to me is the biggest thing. I would love to see eventually in time this third coach be a real thing to where they can actually coach as well. I think that would be – I think there are a lot of people that are, whether it be former players or guys that want to coach, that could really be beneficial to a lot of programs around the country if we allowed a third coach to coach. And I just think that's something that really has to be looked at. You know, football's adding coaches, basketball's adding coaches. You know, I think a third coach would be very, very, very advantageous to all of our programs.
Well, originally, when you were in college, assistant coaches, just the first assistant, was rare.
Yes.
And even though you had that first assistant, he couldn't coach at the same time the head coach was coaching. So I think it's a natural progression now that we have three coaches available to us that make sure that all three could coach at the same time.
Yes. And I'm huge on evaluating our players. And I feel like sometimes you don't get a fair evaluation of a kid when you don't get a chance to watch him play in a tournament. Second thing is, I think the golf courses we play, the way they are manicured, you know, a college kid is very blessed to play the places that he plays. I mean, I know just with our program, the courses that we play when we go down to Florida for our practice trips, when we go out early to a tournament and play some of the courses that we play, I mean, it's an incredible experience. I mean, I remember Morris Williams playing when the airplane's flying in and you're kind of ducking to miss the plane. You know, there's so many courses that have great history that we played in college, but the courses we're playing today, like, you know, unbelievable facilities and unbelievable opportunity for these kids. And then I also think the junior golf talent that's coming to us is incredible. I think the number of opportunities for young players, I see college golf right now in maybe the best place it's ever been from a talent standpoint, a coaching standpoint. And I just can't imagine that this game is just not going to continue to grow. The players are more talented, the speed, the athleticism. I mean, it's really just crazy how much different it is. And you know, the last thing obviously would be the athleticism of these young kids is the thing that has changed tremendously.
You know, you mentioned the junior golf talent, but that means we have more great junior players to fill more rosters in college. And yep. It just reminded me, we played the final round of our Hawaii tournament back in November with Loyola Marymount. And I mean, Loyola Marymount didn't have much before Jason got there. Yep. And Jason D'Amore, he's done a fantastic job. And they won that golf tournament. They won it with a Texas kid that I should have recruited, but I didn't.
Yep.
And but the point is that team wouldn't have been as good a team as they are now years past. Mm-hmm. And what they've done is gone out and recruited really, really good talent because it's available. And they've gone out and gotten
available.
It.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure. So that's great change, as you mentioned, but I'm going to ask you about maybe some that you may not think are quite as good, and that would be NIL and or the transfer portal, either one or both. What are your first thoughts? You don't have to go too deep into this
Yeah,
if you
no,
don't.
I think when you look at where we are right now, I just think we're in a place that some change is going to be necessary in the next 3 to 5 years before it gets out of control. And I don't like the fact, one of the things for me growing up as a kid, Dan Marino played for the Miami Dolphins. John Elway played for the Denver Broncos. Roger Staubach played for the Dallas Cowboys. Terry Bradshaw played for the Pittsburgh Steelers. You had name association with teams. Now, when you turn on a basketball game or a football game, okay, Joe Smith, transfer from such and such. That's just a really bad, it's just a really bad look to me. And the amount of money that institutions are spending, number one, to recruit these players, bring them and their families in on visits, and then once they arrive, the money that's being spent in travel, equipment, food, academic service, I mean, you just go through the whole dynamics, let alone the scholarship the player is getting. You could probably summarize this in probably 25 or 30,000 additional dollars per year to the scholarship, just in travel, food, people helping out. It's like, where's that value? And I get the NIL stuff. I think it just has gone to a point where the intention, I think, initially was great. Where it is landing right now is not good. It's not good. It's giving these kids self, maybe self-belief that maybe they don't need the amount of money that some of these kids are getting paid. It's not they don't bring that value to the program. The transfer portal, I get it. If a player goes to a place and he's not happy, or there's a new coaching change, I get all that. But where are the days when you roll your sleeves up, you go out and get in the dirt? Go ahead and hit some balls, get in the dirt and get better. That's the part that I don't like, that if a kid doesn't like a situation, he can bail. Well, it isn't going to get better in the other situation if you continue doing what you're doing. I don't like that a kid can play at four or five different schools. We have a basketball player that was came in for a year. We fought like crazy to get him eligible through the NCAA. Then he transfers at the end of the year to a fifth school in 5 years. What that's just, to me, that is absurd. And it's absurd to your fan base who are supporting these kids from the day they get here. So, I'm not a huge fan of it, Mike. I hope that it changes. I had a great conversation with our basketball coach about this. If NIL ever came into my program, which it's going to have to at some point, is the kid coming to play for you, the school, or the money? I want kids to come in and play for me. I want kids to come in and play for my program because they know what they're going to get when they enter my program. They're going to get a coach that loves them and cares for them and puts them in the best opportunity to learn and grow as a player and a person. And I see some of that now. I said to our basketball coach, how many of these guys are coming in to play for you? Not really sure. That's a problem as a coach.
Yeah, but it's not that coach's fault. And
Yes.
I get it with you. I agree. Some kids get in a situation that's just not right and they need to transfer. And I'm 100% okay with
Happens.
that.
Yep.
But we've opened the door where I don't feel very good or the coach didn't pick me. I'm out of here. It's
Right.
like that's probably a little strong, don't you think?
That's where I am with that.
Yeah.
That's where
Well,
I
hopefully some guardrails get up that and I've preached this 100 times on this podcast. If they could take the transfer portal and at least require a meeting, that's an administrator, mom and dad, the player, and the coach. Let's talk this out. If we can't make sense of it, then I'll sign the release and you can leave.
You can go.
but he should have to have some sort of meeting with an adult.
Agreed. Agreed. Agreed.
Okay. Let's talk real quick before we're done here. I want to talk, and thank you so much for spending an hour with me. It's been great.
Absolutely.
Talk about the bubble. I've been in the bubble before. It's not a fantastic place to be. And the best side of that bubble is when you're on the other side and you have a regional bid. So what are you thinking about? We're going to find out next Wednesday, 2 days after this podcast airs, whether you're going to a regional or not. What are you thinking on that line?
Well, I mean, you know, I've talked to our team a little bit about this. You know, we try to take care of our own business. You know, I think when you look at the dynamics of where college golf is and how the teams are being evaluated, we kind of buttered our own bread with this situation. In the second round, we played at the Big 12 Championship, being the worst round in the field, having an extremely poor stretch of holes in Houston's event. Those two or three rounds there ultimately are going to dictate where we end up. But, you know, at the same time, one of my bigger concerns is we play the fall season. We're 48th in the country. We don't hit a shot until the first week of March, and we start the spring season the 60th ranked team in the country. So you look at 12 spots that we dropped, not even playing. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is a concern for our sport. And I know I'm not alone. I know there's some other friends that, you know, are in a similar situation to us that we've talked about. But at day's end, it comes down to one simple thing. If you don't like where you are, play better. Mm. And that's what I told my guys. You know what? If you don't like where you are, play better. We could have not played the fourth and fifth and sixth hole at Houston as poorly as we did in that north wind. But we did. We made our own bed, making doubles and triples there all 3 days. That's on us. We didn't have to make doubles and triples there. We didn't have to make a triple and eight doubles in the second round at conference because we drove the ball erratically in the heather. We didn't have to do that, but we did that. And so, you know, my thing with my team is I've told my team, we have to live with the things that we did and not let it happen again.
Well, I mean, I agree. It's what we go through every year. We're all responsible for our score.
Yep.
And if it was that easy, we'd all finish tied for first. It's not that easy.
Yep.
So I'm thinking about you and hoping that you guys get that bid. That would be fantastic. And if you do, we'll see you at regionals and hopefully at La Costa after that.
Yep.
Okay. Well, okay. Hey, listen, Doug, I really appreciate this. It's been great. You gave some great history that I didn't know. So I learned something here today. And I love your coaching philosophy. Just keep it up. Keep doing what you're doing and keep working hard. That always pays off.
I appreciate you having me on this podcast. You're someone that I've held in high regard for an extremely, extremely long time. And you've been successful from the women's program to the men's program to where you are at Baylor. And I know a lot of players who have played for you, and they all have nothing but high praise for you, as I have extremely high praise for you and tremendous respect for you and your teams.
Well, the same goes for me with you. So let's just keep trucking and welcome officially to the Big 12 Conference.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
All right, you bet.